Hey, Larry, is it cold over there yet?
No, it is not. It's cool, though.
Cool? So what do you call cool? I mean, so it's New Mexico is cool like 70 degrees?
No, it's a little cooler than that. It's going down in the 40s at night, 30s, okay. but not cold. We can handle 30s.
And do you still have the swamp cooler on then?
Well, I don't have one of those, but most people would have disengaged those devices by now because the fear of the freezing nights. If it gets down to 32 or 31, you're going to have frozen tubing that supplies the water. So they would have those things disconnected.
You probably would even want to add some humidity a little bit to the air, because this time of year, with it being, you know, chilly-ish and then being super dry, good grief, you would want some humidity in the air then, I think.
Yeah, you would, but you don't use the swamp cooler to generate. You have to have a humidifier for that.
Sure.
But we got this global audience, and very few people know what a swamp cooler and evaporative cooler is.
Well, they'll just have to read up on it on Wikipedia.
Yeah, well, why don't you fire one up in Georgia and tell me how well it works?
I can only imagine it would not help me very much here. We need to remove the humidity from the air. Well, we had a whole bunch of new patrons sign up this week. I guess we touched some nerves over the week, and we had 3 new people sign up, which is pretty freaking awesome, if you ask me.
Well, is that a record week, or have we ever had more?
I think one week we had something like 3. It was 4-ish or so months ago. I could look back and find it. But we would like to thank our newest patrons, Ellen, Brian, and Shantae. So thank you very much for joining Registry Matters, and y'all joined at the hustle level. So that's rocking. And you too can become a patron, and you can receive your own blue balls. And you can do that over at patreon.com/registrymatters. Join the many others who generously support the podcast. We really, really appreciate y'all so very much. Makes this a lot, I don't know, it changes it from just a labor of love to something that, you know, hey, Larry and I can go out to dinner every now and then.
Isn't that fantastic? I'm gonna be doing that in the next 2 months. I'm gonna make a trip to the Peach State, and we're gonna do that.
Outstanding. Let's roll the clock back to last Wednesday or so. That was the fun time of Halloween for our people. It's like the anti-holiday for our people. So there was the marathon call with Narsal that I thought went really well, at least from a technology standpoint. And then also the participation was really high. But then there was also plenty of activity going on from the Narsal angle, you know, with patch.com letters, and Georgia was acting kind of crazy.
Yes, it was definitely an exciting period of time, and depressing to see that we continue to find new levels of humiliation and civil rights violations to impose upon people who are trying to live their lives normally and raise their families, and they're having their employment disrupted. They're having signs placed in their yard without any statutory authority. Having flyers posted on their door without any statutory authority. And I'm not saying even if there were statutory authority, these would be permissible. But we have sheriffs in Georgia that have decided, even without statutory authority, that they're going to put metal signs and post flyers on people's door. And we find that appalling. And we took action, and we sent letters to the sheriffs, asked them not to do it. And as far as we know, they did it anyway. So we're looking now at what legal recourse we have.
Can we dig into the statutory authority piece? So me, as someone that's still on supervision, can the sheriff just show up on my property and stake a sign in the ground that says whatever the heck they want? Or what authority would they have, or would they not have, to do anything of that nature?
Well, if the sheriff is acting under the registration, under the state statutory scheme, they would have only the authority that either the state of Georgia or a county or a city municipality in Georgia has granted them. And neither of those sheriffs could cite to any such authority. If they were assisting the probation department, who had imposed conditions on their offenders while they were under supervision, clearly they have the opportunity to partner with other law enforcement personnel, that being the supervising authorities, that doesn't mean that those signs would be constitutionally valid. It means that they would at least be operating under an authority. They were operating under no authority whatsoever in the counties of Butts and Spalding.
Right, which is sort of like a suburb of Atlanta to the south.
They just decided that they were going to do this because it plays well in the media, and I don't know if those two particular sheriffs up for election. I would imagine that they are. I don't know if they have competition. But even if they don't have competition for this election, it gets their name well known. Right. So for whatever office they may, when you run for sheriff, that's not the only office you can ever hold. There are people who hold, for example, there was a congressman who served in the U.S. House of Representatives who was a sheriff from Ohio named James Traficant. He was known to be a little bit on the loony side, and he was the one that said, "Beam me up, Scotty. I can't take it here." he finally got sent to prison. He had a checkered career where the feds tried to lock him up for some fraudulent activities, and the jury acquitted him because they liked him as a sheriff, and they acquitted him. And then a decade or two later, they managed to succeed in incarcerating Traficant. But regardless of whether the sheriffs and Spalding and Butts were up for re-election this year, I don't know. That doesn't mean that they're not trying to get their name in the news. And one of them ended up making national news on ABC with what is his name, Muir.
It was the Butts County one.
Yeah, but the news broadcaster
wasn't that Dix? D-I-X?
No, that's Dix is in Spalding. But
my bad.
ABC newscast was Scott Muir. Is that his name?
The newscaster. I don't know. I don't follow that. I didn't see it.
Yeah. Well, he made national news. They didn't call his name, but they said the Butts County Sheriff.
Oh, all right. And then I was just going to bring up, just like Joe Arpaio, our favorite Putz former sheriff, who was then going to run for senator, just to give another example of someone that's trying to aspire to the next higher office.
Well, he did in fact run. He did not win the primary.
Right.
He's not the nominee. But yes, people that run a sheriff is not necessarily the end of their political aspirations.
Just a stepping stone. And then you sent me a YouTube video that is tangentially related, that where the government is using their powers for shaming and abuse and so forth. I'll have a link in the show notes. It's a little bit disturbing, and you know, depending on your political affiliations and all that, you may be in favor of, you may not be in favor of what they were doing, but they're caning homosexuals on stage in front of a cheering public in Indonesia.
Well, the reason why I put that in there is because we just had an episode in the last week with an offender who registered in Rhode Island. I forget what city in Rhode Island, but he registered, and he had a particularly heinous crime in New York. And the sheriff and the authorities in Rhode Island are shaming him, and that's caused the public to, I think we have a clip of it, played it last week, but that's caused the public to gather around his house and demand that he go.
Here, let's listen to that clip. It's a pretty small gaggle. I mean, it would still be, you know, I wouldn't want them in front of my house, but it's not like there's hundreds of people and the streets blocked off. It's just about 15 or so people, and they're kind of haphazardly organized.
Well, in contrast, that Indonesia, where in that clip there are many more with their cell phones taking video and cheering and even laughing at the 83 lashes with a cane would be excruciatingly painful.
Yeah,
and hopefully that would, under our cruel and unusual punishment clause, would not be tolerated if that were to be proposed as a form of punishment in the U.S. But I'm looking beyond the actual caning in terms of the registry, the publication of people on a list that allows for this to happen. It's the government using the tools and power of government, like the people, like it's being done under that regime in Indonesia. They're using the power of government and the tools of government here in the United States to put people in that type of danger. It doesn't take much for a mob to escalate. People do things in a mob that they would never do individually.
Right.
And the right little spark with those 15 people chanting outside of his house could cause them to escalate in terms of attacking the property and then maybe breaking inside the property. It is a sad day in the U.S. that we are using governmental tools to do this and to incite angriness and vigilantism. And with all the documented vigilantism related to people on the registry, which many of them have proclaimed that that's how they found them and that was their motivation.
Right.
A lot of others that we don't know that that's why it happened, but we can only assume there's many documented incidents of people in the registry being assaulted and killed. And this is kind of sad in the United States of America that our government is doing this. And it should be causing people to be outraged at the angry mob in front of the person's house, saying, what kind of country are we living in where we can use the tools and levers of government? I think it's the police officials that's actually inciting that angry mob there in Rhode Island.
Right. Hey, let me play this for you. I told you about this one.
And actually, I don't blame them as politicians. I blame us as voters.
Do you know who that was?
I don't know, but it sounds kind of familiar to the voice.
Yes, it's Arnie Duncan. There was an interview that you wanted me to watch on a PBS program. And that's him saying, in all of the political turmoil that's going on, what you were just describing to me just says, you can't believe that in the United States of America and all the, you know, that whole list of things that you say. Yes, it is the politicians, but we elected the politicians. So we are the ones that are accepting of the conditions of the people. It's not maybe necessarily us, you and me, but it's your neighbor. It's the apartment complex down the street. It's the neighborhood up the road. Those are the people that are voting for these politicians that are making these things happen. It's us doing it to us.
It is. And there was a time in my life, and I am kind of an old codger, but there was a time in my life where when a person had paid their debt to society, they would be defended by society at large. Well, he did his time. Give him a chance. That's the past.
Right.
But that doesn't seem to apply anymore.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Let's move on before this turns into a spiraling, just depressed rant for an hour and a half about the sad state of affairs of the United States.
Well, why don't you just leave, Andy?
You know, I do ultimately think that it's a neat country. It does have so if we voted our way into it. I used to listen to this program while I was locked up. Some doctor, he was into like homeopathy and all this stupid shit. But if you would diet and exercise your way into bad health, then that means you could diet and exercise your way out of bad health. And I'm going to think the same thing. If we have voted our way into these poor policies, we can vote our way out.
Well, that was the answer I was looking for. But we get that criticism from time to time about if we're so unhappy. We happen to love this country, and we feel fortunate that we were born here. And we want to try to right the direction and correct the misdirection. And we want to improve this country. It can be far better than it is, although it's already great. We don't have to make it great again. It is great.
I would agree. That would mean, but we came off of our plateau of greatness.
We can make it even greater. We can make it a more fair and just and equitable society. We can make it a forgiving society. We can do a lot to make America greater, but that doesn't mean we're not great. We're not saying that. None of us want to go to South Sudan.
Really? It's the newest country in the world.
Or to live under Sharia law, or to live in most of the Middle Eastern countries, or many Latin American countries. We get that this country is far better, but we want to make it as great as it can be.
Better-er.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on. So I want to leave this quick note. If you call in and leave a voicemail message, I need you to take just a couple minutes and formulate your thoughts, maybe take a couple notes. The system's only going to let you leave a 3-minute voicemail message, which is already too long. If you have a lot of detail and stuff and it's worth playing and your information is concise, then it's great. Leave the 3 minutes. But if you're going to call and leave 5, 12, 20 messages and go, oh, wait, no, take this out. No, I didn't mean this. I can't do anything with it and I can't play it. Just wanted to put that out there just as a administrative thing. Try and formulate your thoughts. Keep it 60, maybe 120 seconds, and then we can play it on the program. But our newest patron, Shantae, she called in. She has a question about transferring from Alaska to Virginia.
Hello, my name is Shantae, and I called before about this matter, the same matter. My son is incarcerated in Alaska, and once he finished his time, hopefully we can go back to Virginia where we live. And I want to know the process of doing that. And I also wanted to know the living restrictions in Alaska and living restrictions in Virginia, how far they can live from schools and places like that. If you can give me a little bit more information about those two things, that would be great. Thank you and have a great day.
That was a perfect example of a voicemail message that we can work with. It's a little bit light on details, but we'll try and flesh some of those out here in a little bit. So I had some correspondence with Shantae, and I sent her a link to the NARSAW wiki that might have some information about the state laws, and you know, so she could look up Alaska and Virginia. I also sent her this PDF that I got. It says when a sex offender comes to visit, and it has a huge chart in the middle of it that gives you, it's like a researcher at a college, and it gives the varying pieces of information if you are traveling to another state of how long it is before you have to register. But it also has the information in there that tells you if you actually stay there, what are your registration requirements? But that said, I think we have some assumptions that we have to make. So we're going to assume that the crime occurred in Alaska and it's a state-level crime, and that post-prison, while still on probation or parole, wants to move to Virginia. I'm pretty sure that whatever the living restrictions are in Alaska will be what is applied in Virginia. It's not, let's just say, for example, if there aren't living restrictions in Virginia, you're still going to have to follow the ones of Alaska. Am I right so far?
It depends, Andy. Let's go.
I tried.
Let's start with your assumptions that he is being released from a state prison, and I don't know of any federal facilities in Alaska. He's being released from a state facility as a result of a commission of a state crime, and let's assume he has a period of supervision to follow, either it be probation or parole. The Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision has a website with a lot of information on it. The ICAOS. And in terms of the process, whether it be probation or parole, if he has a supervised, any reporting requirements, he'll have to be transferred under that ICAOS process. And states to process an outgoing application, they have to be willing to allow the person to leave because it's a privilege to be supervised in another state. So Alaska has to be willing to allow him to apply. And they are permitted under the Interstate Compact to charge application fees for processing all the paperwork that the receiving state, which Alaska would be the sending state for purpose of the compact, and Virginia would be the receiving state. And Alaska charges $100 for a parole application and $100 for a probation application. And just to compare it, I pulled up the chart. Arizona charges $200 for a parole application. Arkansas charges $100. California doesn't charge anything. Colorado doesn't charge anything for parole. Connecticut doesn't charge anything. So it varies from state to state. Most people in that condition are not going to have gobs of money to pay these fees. So it puts them in a real bind because they want to know that their odds of being accepted are pretty good before they spend the $100, right?
Sure. So, you would want to pave as many, clear as many hurdles as you can, having an address and all that stuff before you would try and put in the process.
That's the most crucial thing that the person who's going to sponsor him, we can assume additionally that he does not have a functioning household of his own that's just sitting there waiting that he's been paying rent or that he was a homeowner in Virginia. So whoever he's going to live with is going to have to be involved in the process to the extent that they're going to have to be willing to cooperate with an investigation. So the offender is going to contact the people in Alaska that do reintegration, and each state has more. Depends on how committed they are to reentry, and some states have less. I can't speak for Alaska, but if they have any planning process and social work process, they can begin that process as he gets closer to release. And Shantae didn't say exactly how close he is to release. If he's going to be released in 2025, that's a little bit early. If he's going to be released in 2019, this is probably a good time to be thinking about it. He can get the application process started. The problem that Shantae is going to run into is that Virginia really doesn't want him.
Right.
And it's not anything personal at all.
Well, let's back up. So why doesn't Virginia want him?
Well, Virginia doesn't want him because he's in a category of offenders that they deem to be highly, highly dangerous as a group, not as an individual. They don't know him as an individual, but what they do know is that there's going to be a small percentage of them that will commit new offenses. And maybe it's 1%, maybe it's 3%, maybe it's 5%, who knows? But whatever that percent is, they don't want that person to be on their caseload and that camera to come in rolling, asking how that person managed to commit this offense. And they shouldn't have even been here to start with because their conviction's out of Alaska. And what type of supervision were you guys doing? And how did this happen? They don't want that on their watch. So it's quite common that the states, when they look at these applications, when it's a sexually related crime, they go by the letter of every rule and regulation they have in terms of trying to figure out a way that they can say no to that offender. If they have Virginia's supervision restrictions will apply to him in terms of if they don't allow an offender with a sexual conviction to be within 1,000 feet of all these things, that sponsor's home can't be within any of those exclusionary zones. So they'll just arbitrarily say no. If that offender's sponsor happens to have certain type of convictions, because they'll ask them about themselves. If that person happens to have criminal convictions, they may say no, that association is not going to be good for this. They will look for something. I have not heard of the state yet who says, welcome to all people who have sexual convictions. Go ahead and apply here, and we'll get you in as quick as we can. So for Shante to understand that they're going to be looking for a reason to decline. There's no phone number you can call that I'm aware of in any state to say, hey, I'm just curious. I'd like to sponsor a sex offender.
Right.
Can you give me all the information I need to help me figure out if my house will work for them? It's very unfortunate, but there's no such hotline that I know to call. And in terms of the point you were making about the restrictions, Alaska's restrictions that are in the statute won't come with him, but the conditions that are in his supervision packet will. So if the judge imposed any conditions on him, they will all follow him. But if the Alaska statute says you can't live within 2,000 feet of something, and Virginia doesn't have that, that doesn't follow him if it's in the statutory scheme. But all of his conditions from Alaska that are imposed by either the parole board or the court will follow him, and they must be enforced by Virginia, in addition to whatever Virginia's conditions are. And Virginia, where it gets tricky, the receiving state can impose conditions consistent with what they impose on their own offenders with that type of offense. Okay. So when you come to Virginia, if Alaska doesn't have curfews and Virginia does, don't tell us your problem about Alaska that they didn't impose a curfew on me. You can stay in Alaska if you like, and you won't have a curfew. Right. But we do curfews here in Virginia, and you're in our phased system, and you'll start with a 6 p.m. curfew, and you might get up to 9 or 10 o'clock at night after you advance through our levels. And if you don't like that, you're certainly free not to apply to come here. So do you get double whammy. You don't actually get a benefit by going to a new state. People think that, well, I'll just transfer to a state where they're much more reasonable. Well, the fallacy of that is that they are obligated to enforce the sending state's conditions that were put on your supervision. And if they can't, for any legal reason, they can't, then they're obligated to advise the state, we can't do that, and the state has to remove those conditions if they want to allow you to come. But they're obligated to enforce those conditions. Now, I can't say they do enforce everything.
Yeah, sure.
But that's what they're supposed to do.
It doesn't seem like for a probation officer to, you know, they have 100-something person caseload, and everybody's following this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 set of rules, and then this one person has this different set. I can't imagine they'd be like, oh, we got to manage this guy different. They would try and bring them and make them all as easy as possible to manage and make them all roughly the same.
Well, you are correct. But if they're wanting to get rid of, if they're wanting to get rid of you,
right?
Most POs assess you at first meeting. Whether you're trouble or whether you're going to be compliant. And if they're trying to get rid of you, you better believe they'll watch all those out-of-state conditions looking for a way to send you back to that state for violating that state's conditions. They sure certainly will.
Let me, I just have to get clarification. If you are coming from a state that has residency restrictions and you move to a state that does not have them, and I'm talking it's in the state statute, those don't follow you to the receiving state?
They do not, because that's the state law that you're no longer under.
I swear I thought that those followed you.
The state's law doesn't follow you. Your conditions of supervision do. Now, there are exceptions to every rule, Andy. It's like people who move to Utah with an out-of-state conviction. Utah has adopted the longer of our rules or the convicting state. So if you get to Utah, you might have had a lifetime conviction. A registry obligation out of Florida, and you get to Utah thinking you're going to be under their 10-year plan, and they say, nope, you came from a state that had a lifetime, so therefore your lifetime here. But if there's a town in Alaska that has a 1,000-foot restriction, that doesn't follow you to Virginia. Virginia's restrictions, if they have any, are what control you in terms of the law. But if it's written into your conditions, it does follow you. Those conditions follow you. Well, they don't
that
follow
makes,
you, actually.
That confuses me again. I swear I thought that the state statutes would were the ones that followed you, and your probation ones would be dependent upon your local jurisdiction of probation. So, you know, you're leaving from this county, and here are the normal rules, the curfew, et cetera. You go to the new state, those are kind of all awash. It's whatever they want you to follow in the new state.
The statutory schemes of the state apply. The conditions of the convicting state apply.
All right. I'll have to let you have that one as you being the expert. I am putting a link in the show notes to point people to what turns out to be episode 2 of the Registry Matters podcast that was released on October 28th. So 53 weeks ago, this one was released where we did a hour-long episode on the Interstate Compact.
Well, that would be good for Shantae, but I do feel for her because this is one of those things where it's difficult to try to figure out what to do unless she has stacks of $100 bills.
Right.
And most people don't. And you need to try to position yourself as best you can that you don't get turned down, and you don't know how to position yourself because it's hard to call anybody to get the straight scoop. I don't know where she lives. I don't know if there's any local restrictions there. I don't know anything about, I don't know if she has a criminal history. I don't know anything that would tell me if she would be a suitable sponsor.
And what should she do to try and, you know, fill in all those gaps?
I wish I could be more helpful. It's hard to tell her. I mean, if we had a functioning Virginia affiliate, and I'm not sure Narsil does, they might be more helpful, but it would require me to do an immense amount of research to try to figure out if she would fit within. She would have to research her own background in terms of knowing if she has anything that would exclude her. And then remember, also, all the rules of the supervision apply to you. The probation can't tell you that you can't have a gun if you're allowed to own one, but they can tell you they can't live there if you do.
Yeah, right.
And there's a lot of things that people get angry about that they're going to have to comply with if they're going to have an offender in their house. Probation may tell you that you have to keep your dogs chained up. Well, you may not want to do that. Well, we want full access to your yard, and we don't want a vicious dog charging us when we come in the driveway, so your dog's got to be restrained. Well, they can't tell you to get rid of the dog. They can tell you the person can't live there, though.
Right. Yeah. Well, I hope that's helpful, and I hope the links are also helpful. To let us know how it goes, keep us up to date. We also have a voicemail message from our favorite listener from the UK. Here we go.
Hi, guys. I do apologize. The system is so complex here in the United States, so sometimes I get a little bit confused. So I thought that the SORA proceeding for a risk level determination in New York was a civil proceeding. And I emailed the Division for Criminal Justice Services and I asked them if they could confirm if the SORA proceedings are conducted under civil law, because I wanted to know when they requested my records from the United Kingdom, was that under civil procedure law? And they responded and said that the SORA proceeding is criminal, not civil. So I'm a bit confused because I thought that the registry was civil regulation. So maybe it's only the registry part that is civil and not the actual risk level hearing, determination hearing. Maybe that's criminal part and then it becomes civil. I'm not too sure. I was wondering what you guys thought about that, but they sent me an email today.
Okay. That starts getting kind of in the weeds too about is if it's civil, does it fall under criminal or civil law?
And unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to give them a satisfactory answer. But it is a great question, actually, because we hear this, it's a civil regulatory scheme. But in the states where they actually have, in some of the states where they have risk levels, the judges that presided over the criminal case decide the risk level. And I'm not sure how New York does it. So he asks questions that are beyond my knowledge. But if it's the actual criminal judge who does the risk determination, it blurs the line, doesn't it?
It does.
If you're in the state of Arkansas, you go before the Sex Offender Assessment Board in Pine Bluff. And then if you disagree with them, you can take it to court. And I'm a little unclear if that's a civil or criminal proceeding. As far as I believe I recollect, it's a civil proceeding. But if you're going back to the criminal judge in New York, if that is what's happening, it seems to very much blurry the lines. And then it begs the question, what do you do with non-New York convictions. How do you determine their risk level? There's no judge for them to go before. So you would have to start a brand new proceeding. If the person was going back to their sentencing judge, you would already have the old criminal case number and you would proceed under that within that vehicle. But this is stuff. It sounds like he really does need to get himself some competent representation, which is also challenging because this is an area of the law that's very complicated and people generally don't have gobs of money to hire attorneys, and you could end up spending a lot of money and not know much more than what you know after you talk to the attorney, because the attorney may tell you, I don't know. Thanks for the $250 for the consultation.
Right. I find it fascinating that it's a quote unquote civil regulatory scheme, and the civil regulatory scheme, if you don't follow it, it puts you back in prison.
Well, you and others mentioned that the civil regulatory schemes can put you in prison if you don't follow them.
Right. I mean, I guess taxes is a civil regulatory scheme too, right?
Well, restaurant inspections are a civil regulatory scheme that can put you in prison if you continue to defy the authorities on operating without a permit. There's a number of things that can put you, driver's licenses can put you in jail if you don't have one and you continue to drive without one.
But you keep saying if you continue to have these infractions, it's like eventually, like there's a slap on the wrist, then there's a small fine, then there's a big fine and so forth. Then eventually, but this is like, hey, you missed curfew by 5 minutes, you get locked back up.
Well, the registry is not a curfew. As far as I know, there's no curfews except for, but the registry violations have been elevated through the years in terms of, and there again, that's from the public pressure. For example, my state, it's a maximum 18 months for violating the registry, which it's a day for day good time. It's not a violent offense. So it's, you're looking at 9 months. I wouldn't want to serve 9 months for a regulatory violation, but nobody actually ever does the nine. I shouldn't say nobody. Seldom does anybody ever serve the 9 months, because unless they're just willfully disobeying time after time after time, it's usually a probated sentence here. But a violation of regulatory scheme, the sex offender regulations are very tough and the penalties are very harsh, but the merely fact that there are criminal penalties associated does not magically make that regulatory scheme punitive. That is not what will take to win to say that because they impose punishment, you don't comply. It's not just a fine. That is not enough to transform a regulatory scheme into a punitive one. That by itself won't do it.
Then let's move on to, hey, let's, okay, everyone put on your don't throw tomatoes at the podcast host mode. Put those hats on. We got an email message from Jonathan, and he says, I enjoy the podcast, and I usually don't mind the politics, but twice now I've heard something that I want to push back on. The idea that to be a strict constitutionalist, you must be for banning modern weapons, and that the founders could not have envisioned machine guns is a bit misleading and possibly false. The email message goes on with a whole lot of more information about Second Amendment kind of things, or other examples of where military weapons are used in various situations, and even like Civil War weapons that would be considered like, automatic weapons and so forth. I totally respect your opinion on this, and I kind of want to move away from this whole thing, but the conversation comes up all the time about, do you follow the letters of like the actual the actual written words of the Constitution? Do you interpret it? Do you let it evolve to modern standards? And we kind of like go back and forth. We allow it to happen in certain conversations, and then we refuse to let it go on in other conversations.
Well, the word he actually said was constructionist, not constitutionalist. But I really appreciate someone like Jonathan who will take the time to write something that's respectful and factual. As far as I can tell, everything he wrote was factual, and I appreciate it. He would be the type of person I'd be delighted to have a debate with, and we could probably be respectful for an hour and a half and carry this debate, which is really not the purpose of the podcast, but we could probably do that. But I will say that his point kind of self-defeating. First of all, the gun that he talks about was never produced for armies, whatever it was called, that weapon. I'd never heard of the Puckle gun. I'd never heard of it, but it looks like it was the early version of a machine gun that would fire like 7 or 8 bullets
a minute.
Yeah. But that's not really the point. The point is that if you're textualism and strict constructionist run hand in hand, and a textualist does not believe in guessing anything that's not there. And his own message, Jonathan's own message here, says that he believes that the framers would have intended for people to be on weapons as they evolved, consistent with what the military would have available to them. And I can respect that, but I disagree with that. Because if they had wanted to say that, they could have said that. There's fundamental disagreement about what the Second Amendment actually means to start with in terms of a well-regulated militia being necessary to secure the freedom of a free state, or however that's worded. There's a lot of debate about what that actually means, about whether it even gives the individual a right to own a weapon. It wasn't until 2008, in the case of District of Columbia versus Heller, that the Supreme Court expanded that to include the individual right of ownership of a weapon. And I think there was another decision a couple of years later out of Chicago, where the same 5-4 majority affirmed what they'd said in Heller. But until that time, there was no belief and no interpretation of the U.S. Supreme Court that they could individual could own a weapon. But if you're strict textualist, if they had wanted that interpretation that Jonathan says, they would have said that as weapons evolve, the citizens will have the right to own them. They didn't say that. Therefore, you cannot read into it, if you're a textualist, something that is not there. And that's the point we've been making about the case out of Nebraska, trying to compare. There are pros and cons about textualist and intent interpretations. And I won't say that I disagree with all the pros of people who believe in textualism. There's a lot of them I don't agree with. But that is an intellectual argument you can make about textualism versus the intent of what people write in statutory schemes. And we had a great discussion about that over the last several sessions of the podcast. The people in Nebraska got a textualist interpretation.
And they should be happy.
Logically, they should be. If they are textualists, that's what they should say. Well, even though out-of-state juveniles are having to register in Nebraska, that's exactly what the law says. It says anyone who enters Nebraska who has to register another state, you are a person, right? You do have to register another state, right? That is actually right by the book.
How come you say juveniles on the phone different with me?
Well, I had a foster parent who was relatively uneducated, and she had some real pronunciation problems when I was a kid, and she would never, no matter how much you struggle with her, she could not say juvenile, or would not say it. I think she probably could, but she insisted that anybody who was under the age of majority was a juvenile, and you were in get trouble, and they were taking you to the juvenile hall.
And how would she sound?
Well, she just sounded like that. You're going to they're going to put you in juvenile hall.
Seems like when we talk about it, you kind of accentuate that with a little bit more of a southern draw.
So, what do you want to be in the juvenile hall, Andy?
There we go. That's what I was looking for all along. Well, let's move on. We got a mountain of articles to cover.
Well, I really appreciate Jonathan, and I really that's he wrote very respectfully. Thank you for that.
So, Jonathan, feel free to reach out. Maybe we could produce it as a Patreon extra or something like that, to have a 30-minute or something back and forth. I don't know. Something actually that I've always wanted to do with this podcast is get people that are opposed to our position on registry type of subjects to have some kind of debate, almost like the Emily Horowitz, Marcy Hamilton thing that went on there. I think that would be an amazing, amazing production. Finding people that could communicate it well, though, that would be the hard part. That's not just like, F you, sex offenders, you're all bad people, we need to kill you.
And clearly, Jonathan can do that. And I guess I'd take a step further with the Supreme Court. They interpreted I believe it was Riley versus California in 2014. You can check me in Google and see if I'm close, but there was a case out of regarding a search of a person's cell phone. And the Supreme Court, looking at the Constitution in terms of your right to privacy, and they have long since held the doctrine for 40-some-odd years. There was a case that came out in the late 60s, even under the liberal warrant court, that said you can, as an incident to a lawful arrest, you can search a person's, you can search a person, their belongings. If you encounter them in a traffic stop, you can inventory and search the car and search the person. Well, in Riley, the Supreme Court said, whoa, you're just going a little bit too far here. The searching the phone contains too much private information. Their whole life is on their phone. And that was an example of evolvement that the founding fathers, I doubt, would have ever anticipated. But that device, the Supreme Court found it to be equivalent to something that needed protection. And they held that the Constitution protects the cell phone. And it can't be searched other than if there might be a way that something could be hazardous or dangerous in the phone to the office for safety. They can search it to make sure of that, but they can't actually search the digital content. And so let me see if I've got that right, if it's Riley versus California. But anyway, we won't spend a whole lot more time on it. Yeah. But that is an example of the involvement of, you have to look at the times we live in today. Nobody was thinking about cell phones when they said the right to be secure from search or seizure in your person or your belongings.
Like I said, we have a mountain of articles. We pushed a bunch of articles back because we had the interview last week about Nebraska and whatnot. So we're going to try and move through these quickly. And the first one is a lawsuit tests the limits of anonymous speech. This subject comes up on our radar fairly often about being anonymous, maybe online on a Twitter forum or some other internet chat kind of thing. And this article is kind of neat. It presents a whole bunch of neat examples to wrap your head around where you would 100% defend someone's right to be anonymous and then like just change the scenario, just change the details of it, but it's the exact same thing. And you'd be like, no way, absolutely, there should not be anonymity. The one example that I really liked of where you
I think where you're going to go. Say the group about fraternity boys.
No, actually, you know, I was going to talk about like the internal affairs thing with the cops, that if there were a group of cops that were like trying to call out their peers that are corrupt, you would 100% defend their right to have their names be anonymous. I think. I would.
You probably would. I would. I'm not sure the cops would.
But, no, of course, like the one that has his name listed, he would absolutely want to out those people to try and do something to suppress their ability to keep that information in there. And then he's a corrupt, let's just go for the sake of argument that he's a corrupt cop. And he would absolutely want to have that discovery of who's contributing and all that stuff so he can do something to suppress it. But at the same time, you just flip that around and you have some women who are like talking about some people in the office that are doing bad things. You would want to protect their rights too. And then I guess you were bringing up the frat boys and they're passing around a document of who's good in bed and all this stuff.
Well, that was the lawsuit is actually about a person who, I guess they had their name put on a hit list of men who were doing sexual deviancy of sexual assaults and stuff. And the Google is saying, we don't provide that information. This article, which is a good read, it's long, but it would be nice for people to read. If the fraternity boys create a spreadsheet about people's sexual proclivities and they put that online so that people know that they might have a good catch with these people whose names have been listed in photographs, all of a sudden it's different. They don't have the right to anonymous speech. You know, I would encourage everybody to read this because it really is. It does take pro and con of situations, and you'll do flip flops all throughout it. You'll say yes, of course they should, and then you'll say, well, no, they shouldn't have the right to anonymous speech in that situation.
And that's also one of your particular attributes that helps you be successful in the work that you do. Is that it's not just the registry is bad, rah rah rah. What is their argument going to be, and how can you then figure out how to diffuse their argument? Okay, what else? Figure out the 10, 20, 100 different ways they're going to come back at me and what I'm trying to do and try and anticipate their moves. That's kind of what this thing does, is help you flip. Okay, we're going to move this to male-female. We're going to move this one to female-male. We're going to move the situation of this. You know, it's almost like a Rubik's Cube kind of thing, and you're trying to get all the colors to line up in the right way to where you can have everybody be happy on all sides, or at least have the right to representation, have the right to face your accuser, you know. And then obviously this is about the First Amendment.
Yeah, it's a fantastic read in terms of the arguments being made in terms of the right to face your accuser, and then the right to anonymous speech, and where those limits are, and clearly there have to be limits. And intellectually honest people that can look at these issues and come up with different viewpoints. And sometimes we have to say hello to ourselves. We're being inconsistent. I was having a conversation with a gentleman last night about there weren't enough regulatory authorities in a state that he felt there should be more regulation. I said, well, I thought you were a strong conservative. I didn't believe that. I thought regulation was a part of the problem. Now you're saying that the polygraph examiner should be monitored and regulated by the government, and you're saying the treatment provider should have all these obligations to keep and maintain records and do all these things for a number of years. I thought that was a part of the problem. It's like, well, what would the, you want regulation when it suits your purpose.
Yeah.
And then you don't want to pay the taxes to, for the cost. You want to have to create a brand new governmental entity to regulate the polygraph examiners. Well, that's new spending, recurring spending, to have this board of polygraph examiners and have this bureaucracy. Somebody's got to pay for that at the same time while you hate taxes.
I'm just going to drop this bomb out there. We have an organization called the FDA that regulates drugs, and they regulate food and all these other kinds of things. And a bunch of people come jumping down the throats of the FDA. Let's move that over to, you have a whole section of your pharmacy that offers homeopathy, home remedies, St. John's warts and stuff like that. Completely 100% non-regulated. They can put any crap out there that they want to, and there's no scientific evidence behind it. Take that exact same thing, move that over to the polygraph. It is an identical, we'll call it technology, process, pseudoscience bullshit. There's no regulation behind it, and it should be removed from public consumption in its entirety. It is just a boo game scare thing. Same thing with the homeopathy, the homeopathic remedies. Garbage, no regulations, should be pulled off the shelves and not sold. There. That's my piece. Throw all your hate email at me if you want to.
I was going to say, we're going to get plenty this week about that. Pull all your, what'd you call it, off the shelf?
The homeopathy? Yeah. The homeopathic remedies? It's garbage. Yeah, complete garbage.
Okay. All righty. I can see now our listenership is plummeting as we speak.
Yeah. So you're going to bring up all the conservatard things. I'm going to pick up all the homeopathy. We're going to drive the listenership to zero. That's the goal.
We're going to do this just to sit around on Saturday afternoon, huh?
Yeah, because we just like to hear each other talk.
I see.
The next article comes from vtdigger.org. Never heard of this one. But I guess we'll call it Connecticut. Hartford woman refuses sex offender program. I struggle with this one too, in that let's say you're convicted of a crime that you don't think is criminal, and you end up through your prison program and they require you to take some sort of treatment class. And the treatment class provider says, we need you to sign this statement of acknowledging, you know, of your offense and all this stuff, but you don't believe that your crime was a crime, and they're going to kick you out of the program for not signing the treatment thing. And now you're like stuck in prison purgatory or probation purgatory because you don't agree with them making you sign this this statement of acceptance.
It's a very compelling case when you've been convicted, not pursuant to a plea, but as we know, 90%+ of the cases were resolved with a plea, and so was this individual. And at this point, she's going to get very little traction, in my view, to refuse to acknowledge her crime that she pled guilty or no contest to. And because even in no contest, you're conceding that the evidence is there sufficient to convict you. And I wish I could give different feedback, but I think this is not going to end well for her. This kind of reminds me of a person in Georgia that didn't have time to take a treatment program.
we'll leave that person nameless. But there was a guy that was in my prison treatment class, and he claims that his crime was putting lotion on his daughter's back. I don't know. I don't care. And I didn't do anything wrong. That was my daughter. I did it. And then somehow accusations come down. Don't care. But we have another article coming up next, I think, is why do people take plea deals? And it's exactly that. Now you accept that you're going to get a 5-year sentence versus 20 taking the plea deal, as opposed to potentially being found guilty and taking 20 years. I think the 5 is possibly a better, you know, you have better odds at the 5. So you take the plea, even though you're actually not guilty.
And that's a great article that follows, because the average ordinary citizen, if you went out and started pulling people at random, they were reasonably of sound mind and said, would you ever plead guilty to something you didn't do? You would be hard pressed to find anybody who would say they would.
Because
everybody intuitively says they would not. But if they've never encountered the justice system, they don't know the tactics and the power that the system has. And so intuitively, you're going to say, no, I would never plead guilty to something I didn't do. But when you get put in that position, it's a whole different situation, because if in the states where they have the death penalty, if they say, well, we think our jury will convict you, or we're willing to give you life with parole, and we'll take the death penalty off the table, well, most people want to stay alive for a better day.
Yeah. And one of my first roommates was they offered him a 3-to-1 in the death of his wife. I got to think that if they offered you a 3-to-1, they have really poor evidence. That just would be my take. If they had more strong evidence, then they would go for at least a longer sentence, if not shooting for life. He takes it to court. He loses. He got life. He died in prison. Should have taken the 3-to-1.
Well, that would be a good example of where it was in, would have been in his interest. But he was one of those who couldn't say he did something he didn't do.
Right.
And he died in prison as a martyr.
Yep. And he fought trying to do habeas corpus. How do you pluralize habeas corpus? Corpi? Corpuses?
I don't know how you would do that.
So he was trying to file habeas corpuses or corpi to have a new hearing. He was trying to introduce more evidence, whatever. And he remained unsuccessful. And when I left him, he had done 14-ish years and he died at around 20 years and incarcerated.
Wow.
He may have been 60 when he died. Just the prison system just beat him down.
Well,
just beat his body down.
If you could tell me how to pluralize platypus, I'll tell you how to pluralize.
Same with it's octopi. Just for reference, it's octopi. It's not octopuses because that doesn't sound right, especially on a family oriented program such as this.
But yeah, the lady's going to end up having to do the treatment program, or she's going to pay a horrendous price, in my opinion, for not cooperating. It's going to be a violation of her supervision, and the people plead guilty all the time. And I don't know what they plead guilty all the time for things they haven't done, because it's the best way to resolution. And that was a great example of 3-to-1. The prosecutor didn't think they had a good case would be what part of the equation. And they could have felt like that was in the ends of justice, that they had a case of something, but they didn't have a real strong case, and they were giving him a sweetheart deal. I mean, who knows what went into consideration, but he didn't take it, and they did what they do often when you don't take a deal. They take you to trial, and they beat you.
Right. Yeah, and I just had a thought on that one. But it left my brain. There's that senility showing up for me. You're contagious.
It's that old-timers.
Yeah. Let's keep moving on. There's a website called guiltypleaproblem.org. And picked up this article a couple of weeks ago. It says, why do innocent people plead guilty to crimes they didn't commit? There's one particular fact in there that just kind of freaks me out. From an organization, it says, furthermore, according to the National Registry of Exonerations, 18% of known exonerees pleaded guilty. Okay, so we have something like 2 million people incarcerated. What is that? So 20% of that, that's 40,000 people? No, that's 400,000 people are possibly innocent, and they just pled out.
Well, I wouldn't extrapolate it quite that. That'd be a scary statistic to think that 1 in 5 people are innocent. I wouldn't extrapolate out that, because the innocent projects are usually pretty rigid about the cases they take in terms of you have to have substantial proof of your innocence. But it's a scary number to think of the cases that they did elect to take. That almost 1/5 of them had pled guilty, and they were factually innocent, but for whatever reason, they were able to exonerate them. That is really scary.
But I mean, that's saying National Registry of Exonerations, 18% of known exonerees pleaded guilty.
Yeah, but see, to get exonerated, to get an innocence project, take your case. They deny 88-90% of everybody who approaches them, because you don't have any evidence. So they cherry pick the best of cases, and I'm not criticizing them. They have to, because they have very limited resources, and they want to actually get people out where they can prove their innocence. They don't want to go on a wild fishing expedition. So 90%, 95% of the people that approach them are just not cleared. But of the cases they take, the fact that 1/5 of those plead guilty is frightening.
Okay, so that would be similar to saying the Supreme Court gets 7,000 whatever petitions to hear cases, and they only hear a few hundred.
They don't even hear a few hundred. They hear about 80 or 90 of 9,000.
Okay, so similar thing. So the 9,000 would be the 2 million, but they only actually made decisions on 100 cases.
Yeah, these innocence projects are usually very woefully underfunded. There's not a lot of grant money from foundations and from governmental entities to get. It's not like the victim's advocate side where there's plenty of grant money. It's hard to find money to exonerate people that are in prison. So it's often a bunch of people who have social justice in their heart, and they do this part-time as a gig on the side. But finding a funded innocence project is hard to do. There are some where they found ways to fund their work, but it's usually haphazard, and it's part of a law school program. But they have very limited resources, so very very few people get accepted that write to them, and they hear back, "Sorry, we can't help you."
Tragic. The next article is from the Miami New Times. I love this article. I mean, I don't love it. This situation just is completely shitty. We covered an article 3 or 4 weeks ago where a guy that had schizophrenia, I think, at least bipolar. The cops, the corrections officers, they put him in a shower for 2 hours with the temperature set on insanity, and he died in the shower with skins peeling off. This happened, I think, in 2014. No, it was 2012. The guy's name was Darren Rainey. And just a couple of years ago, the medical examiner's report came out with gruesome photos of Rainey's body showing huge portions of the skin peeling off his back and legs and arms and all this. And I brought this up just as kind of like a follow-up. So here's the medical examiner, Dr. Emma Liu. She gets a promotion. So I just wanted to bring that up.
It was. I read the entire thing right before we went on today, and I just couldn't believe that everybody got promoted in that. Practically the other guard did also.
Yeah, he became, instead of being a CO, he became like a beat cop. and then he was out. He was out like sharing time with his girlfriend or whatever. I think he was married too, sharing time at his girlfriend's while he was on duty.
But they gave her a nice raise to $260,000 a year. The medical examiner, and she got many accolades and recommendations about being what an asset she is, and clearly it was a botched job, and there was a settlement to the family. I believe it was like $4.5 million. I don't have that in front of me now, but there was a huge settlement to the family. It says at the bottom here that the family of Darren Rainey settled a civil lawsuit with the state of Florida, Clark and others, for $4.5 million. So it's hard to imagine that you can pay out a $5 million and everybody gets promoted and that we're part of that.
Well, that makes it okay, right? So we've paid out our money. Now we're clear. It's clean slate. Everybody's equal. Everyone get promoted up.
Well, you would think, though, that rationally, I mean, you'd think that the people who were the bad actors here, the medical examiner who gave a bad report and the officers involved, you'd think that they would be demoted and possibly prosecuted. I would think, maybe.
But then doesn't that go to the DA not prosecuting?
I don't know all the specifics, but this accountability is lacking, clearly, in this case.
Do you think that we need some kind of government bureaucracy to possibly have some oversight over these? Maybe some sort of independent kind of commission to oversee the law enforcement apparatus, as you call it?
I would favor that, but it's hard you'd be fighting that over vehement opposition. The cops are they self-police by and large. They have their own internal affairs processes and try to tell the cops that will quickly tell you that they don't need anybody meddling in their business. We as civilians, we don't understand the complexity of police work.
Yeah, no, that's right. We don't. That's why they do their jobs, and we should let them do their jobs without trying to question their authority.
And we should not question the equipment or the tactics. And when they make a split second decision to shoot somebody who is on the floor with a pair of boxers on crawling, we should never question that. I don't know why you don't I don't know why you don't understand that.
Do you know who Cartman is on the cartoon South Park?
No.
Okay. Well, there's this little fat kid. It's a cartoon. It happens in Springfield, Colorado, something like that. Little fat kid. And he's a little obnoxious, little bad kid, and he has this little cop outfit that'll put on. It's like, "You will respect my authority." There you go.
I've never heard that.
Oh my god, I may have to pause the podcast just to go find that.
We can't do that. We got 8 more articles.
Hey, I'm a cop, and you will respect my authority.
All right, the next article comes from Pew, the PewTrust.org, I should say. Probation and parole systems marked by high stakes, missed opportunities. 1 in 55 adults is under community supervision. It's a lot of people, Larry. We got 340 million people in the U.S. and 1 in 55. So that's what is that? I guess that's 2% roughly. That's a lot of people, man. That is a lot of people under supervision.
It is, and as typical, your southern states tend to have the largest number of offenders, both in prison and on probation, apparently, according to the way they've broken it out here.
There's a bunch of charts. It's a long article, but I bet you there's a particular listener in Tennessee that's going to eat this one up. So, Ray, that one is for you. Something that I pulled out of it that I thought that was particularly interesting is one quote that I really want to hammer here is, policy change can reduce correctional control and improve public safety. From 2007 to 16, 37 states experienced simultaneous drops in their community corrections and crime rates. In many cases, these gains followed adoption of evidence-based, remember that when I was talking about the homeopathy stuff a minute ago, evidence-based sentencing and correction reforms that prioritize scarce supervision and treatment resources for higher-risk individuals, invested in risk reduction programs, and created incentives for compliance. Can you imagine, like, Larry, hey, you're going to get out of prison, and if you do well, we're going to keep extending your curfew until you have no curfew at night. You'd be like, shoot, yeah, I'm on board with that. I don't want to have to be home at 5 o'clock at night, so I'll follow the rules and I'll get to have an unlimited curfew. That sounds good.
So, well, I took some. I mean, the article says 4.5 million people were on probation at the end of 2016, but I took something out of it about that probation and parole revocations for technical violations, not new crimes, constitute the largest share of admissions to prisons, particularly in Georgia and Rhode Island. It mentioned that's a 1 in 18. No, that's the wrong part. But there's a ratio of admissions to prison, and the more people you have on probation, the more admissions you're going to have to prison if you rigorously enforce the most slight technical violation.
Such as being late for curfew.
Yeah, although 50-state data are not available, research has found that probation and parole revocations contributed significantly to prison admissions in several states in 2015. Probation revocations made up 55% of all prison admissions in Georgia and 61% in Rhode Island, while parole revocations accounted for 54% of all prison admissions in Arkansas. You kind of see the problem?
I do, very much.
And that these revocations are not necessarily accompanied with new criminality. They're technical violations. And people on the registry who are being supervised can identify with that because they have all of these rules that are just they're I got you moments all throughout the rules that they have.
Anyway, tons of charts. Another very long article. It showed up. It's a little bit old as far as I don't know how it ended up showing on my radar. It's about 6 weeks old. But good article, good information that I think just provides some insight into how our probation system is trapping people, so to speak. Or, you know, it's just crap. When we get out, we're not really being set up to be successful. We have too many barriers and hurdles. Forget being on the registry, because that's just lanyap. And the system is just flawed. And we're the ones that made it.
And just think of all the money that's made off of supervision now, because in some states they've privatized the supervision. I think your state might be one of them, where they've got private supervising entities, particularly at the lower offense level. And then all the technology costs that are related to various types of monitoring, from GPS tracking to alcohol monitoring. And then you have to pay these probation supervision costs, which can be significant.
Yes.
If you got GPS cost and supervision costs to pay, I mean, you can be paying a lot of money. It's an industry. And it's hard to dismantle. It's hard to dismantle industries.
Yeah. Well, I had heard some time ago that your GPS tracking stuff could be several hundred dollars a month. Now they have it included in your cell phone. It's still not cheap, but you know, you already have a phone. So if you tack on the additional cost, it's not, I don't want to word this the wrong way, it's not that bad, because you're already going to pay $50 or $100 a month for a cell phone, and now you throw in the monitoring aspect of it, it's not that much more, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You're not paying for a whole separate, you know, like an ankle monitor to be attached. You know, you're already going to carry your phone. Now you have your tracking device that's just going to be with you.
How do we make sure it's with you?
Get to take a picture, and then also a little voice recognition. So yeah, that's awesome. 2 o'clock in the morning, your screen lights up to take a picture of you, like a flash almost. Yeah, that's not going to wake you up and disrupt your sleep.
Oh, not a problem. I don't see any problem with that.
No, absolutely not.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
And the next article, which is super fun, considering the job situation that we're in now. So myagc.com says that the tight job market leaves Georgia's youth jails chronically understaffed. Well, if we roll back the clock about 8 years or so, I bet the unemployment rate was pretty high, so you could get all kinds of people to work in the prison system. And now that the unemployment rate is, 4-ish% and 7 million open jobs in the U.S., something like that, it's hard to get what?
That's what I was going to say. That's why I threw this article in here, because the booming economy, which has been booming not just for the last 2 years, we've had a very good economy for a number of years, but magically people recognized it last 2 years. But we've got people have heard me say that people don't, when they're looking at their career path, very few people say, I'm all want to work in a jailhouse. Well, there's an exception to that. People do want to gravitate. There are people who actually do want to work with juvenile offenders. And when it's getting to the point that you can't staff the juvenile facilities, which is where people are most likely willing to want to work because they think they can save the youth. And I have met people in my life that said that they want to work with juvenile offenders. I can't recollect that I've met anybody in my life that said, I can't wait to work in adult prison. Man, that's going to be a career path. I can't wait. But here it is that they have major staffing shortages at the place where you're likely to have people willing to work with a juvenile offender population. What does that tell us about what's going on in Georgia's adult prisons right now? I think we can extrapolate.
I can tell you, even when you had the high unemployment rate, it was still understaffed, grossly understaffed. You just can't get people to work in those conditions. It's just too awful. Why would you want to go do that every day and have people cuss you out and spit on you and other things of that nature? Why would you want to go there for a job that pays $12 an hour, $11 an hour?
So, according to this is AtlantaJournal.com, our website, this story ran in Atlanta Journal. According to that, the juvenile detention centers are running at less than 60% of their security staffing positions. Mm-hmm.
So that means if you're in there and some kind of altercation breaks out, there's no one that's going to come rescue you until you have lost all of your teeth and you have an eyeball out of your head.
Yes. And then it said that the youth detention center in Augusta is only at 44% of its officers. Wow. Isn't that great?
Yeah. That means those officers have to work longer shifts. They're already working 12-hour shifts. They're going to be working longer shifts. They're going to be pulled in on their off days. They're going to be cranky. They're going to be tired. They're not even going to want to do the work. So they're going to do as minimal stuff as possible. Hey, if you're in the contraband business, this is probably a great time to be involved in the prison system.
So, I think the solution, Andy, is to kick more people out of the United States.
I thought you were going to say kick them out of prison.
Yeah, because if we already have a worker shortage, which we have a chronic worker shortage in many parts of the country, but it makes sense to me to kick out more people that would be willing to do the work. I've got the answer.
Kick them out?
Kick out more of the people that would be willing to work if we weren't kicking them out. That is the solution.
I see.
Round up people that are here illegally and kick them out, the people that are working, pull them off their jobs. And then we need to fortify the border with armed guards and make sure that no one comes in.
Hang on. Aren't we fortifying the border? I see a picture today of military people laying down?
Yeah.
President trying to ask the Pentagon to give the military more authority to be police?
We're probably going a little too far with this, but my point is that we're in the position right now to absorb immigrants through an orderly process. Immigration reform is long overdue. Now that our economy is suffering, we're actually going to start suffering economic underperformance, because when companies can no longer hire the workers that they need, that cuts their product output if you don't have workers. And so I would say that maybe perhaps this will put pressure on our political establishment to come to an agreement about immigration reforms that'll bring in the people we need under a process where that they can be properly vetted and stop the illegal entries, or at least reduce them. We're never going to stop the illegal entries. We've got long open borders on both north and south, and people are going to want to come to the United States. And the only way we'd stop the illegal entries would be have a country that nobody would want to come to. But otherwise, people are always going to want to come here.
That's sort of like the double-edged sword there. If you have a place that people want to get to, they're going to try and figure out a way to get there.
I mean, I doubt that Mogadishu has Somalia has people beating the doors down, but that's not a place you'd want to be. But U.S. is, as long as we have a great nation, people are going to want to come here. I mean, we should be proud that people are trying to come here, and we should be willing to make it possible for the workers we need to come here. And we need workers right now, and that was my whole point. The country,
yeah,
right
I
now.
Know.
we're Try to build homes in major cities in the construction industries. They're just desperate. Try to run your service industries right now. At hospitality, they're desperate for workers. High tech, certain parts of high tech, I don't understand.
No, all of it. Workers. All of it. Well, and you know, on that note alone, because I follow this particular industry really heavily, the IT security stuff, there's a million jobs available to qualified workers, and it's very high tech, and people aren't going to be interested in it, and it's very technical and all that. I get that. But it's also a six-figure income if you do get there.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a job market that is that deficient of qualified workers, I got to think that they would be like, oh, conviction? Psh, don't care. Tattoos? Don't care. Nose ring? Don't care. Long hair and beard? Don't care. They're just going to keep cutting off the list because they need a person. And if you're qualified in that job, they're going to take all the other things out. Hey, there's funny. There's another article coming up here just about that too.
All right.
Well, I don't know that we've ever covered an article from the California Group's website, but this is from the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense or Sex Offense Laws. And this happened two-ish weeks ago. It says California governor vetoes 8 sex offender bills. The details in the article are kind of light. They do list the bill names, but Governor Jerry Brown, who's a repeat governor. He was governor, 30 years ago? And he's come back
More than 30. He was in the 70s. He's had a variety of jobs, including mayor of Oakland, attorney general, and governor. But we take their word, the Alliance of the Axel people, their analysis that these bills would have been devastating or at least disadvantaging people in the registry, and he vetoed. So what the message I would like for people to take from this is that there are politicians out there who are willing to stand firm and say enough is enough, and Governor Brown is one of them. I know some people probably think he's a liberal, do good,
yep,
wacko, and all that kind of stuff. But Governor Brown, to my knowledge, is the only governor who has ever vetoed a bill that would have disadvantaged registrants. And if anybody else can point out other vetoes, not don't tell me a veto that sex offenders supported, because you could easily cite to Governor Nixon's veto of a bill in Missouri that the offenders wanted a few years ago that would have actually made it better to have a tiered registry and a removal process that would actually be fair, unlike that crappy bill that they just passed. But if there are governors who have vetoed bills that would have made life worse for sex offenders, please let us know, because none's coming up to my memory. So it was really kind of shout out to Governor Brown in California.
And just for historical background, I didn't know you a year ago before we started this podcast. And I just randomly typed in an email address and said, hey, I'm going to start a podcast and I want a co-host. Can you BS your way in knowing about the registry? That's who you are, right?
I'm not following you.
Oh, I'm being silly. That you're kind of an expert on the subject and have been following it for a long time.
Oh, okay. I just don't know of any vetoes where it's going to make it tougher for offenders. Those bills are always signed, whether it be at the presidential level or whether it be at a state level. So Brown is out there by himself. He's been willing to be controversial all through his political career.
I remember when IML was working its way through, and our people were trying to do like letter writing campaigns to try and get Obama to not sign IML. And, you know, he signed IML. That's my only example that I can think of in my time of advocacy.
And I said he would, and any president would have at that time. And I tell people that if these things get to the chief executive, particularly when there's been no opposition below, and as far as right. Obama was concerned, there was no opposition because it was unanimously passed, they're not going to veto something as far as they would think was good legislation, particularly in an election year.
Right.
This thing with Governor Brown, it gives me more admiration for him because he may be kind of wacky in some areas. You may not agree on environmental regulation because California is going full into the renewables. But there again, things are important to you, like not making your life worse. He was there for you.
Yeah. Yep. Well, there was an article in Vox that I don't remember if it was you or me that put this in there. I only wanted to bring it up because of the title really is How Looks Can Influence Courtroom Bias. And there's a guy that was in brought up on charges for inciting kind of like hate speech kind of things.
Well, you missed one about the for-profit prison. Did you want to skip
that? No, I didn't mean to skip that. My bad. I just was looking ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, let's back up.
We could do it quickly, but I thought it was the number of times. It's so hilarious.
Yeah. So we'll run through this one, then we'll backtrack back to that one. So this guy, John Kingsman of the Proud Boys, they show a picture of him like on his original hearing. And I mean, he looks totally like a lumberjack guy. His hair's long. He's got one of the big scraggly beards. He's got overalls on. And you would totally look at him and go, that's a hillbilly. And that would totally be a white supremacist, racist, lynching kind of person. That's what you would think. And then you would go, well, the guy's obviously guilty of whatever he's being charged of. And then they show right side by side of it. He's got some kind of square black frame glasses, you know, maybe like something from the 50s or 60s. He's got his hair cut back, kind of spiky, a little looking trendy. Now he's in a suit and a tie looking like Men in Black. And, you know, he looks just kind of like a normal dude that goes to work on not Wall Street, but, you know, just downtown in an office somewhere. You got to think that would influence how the jury would then, do some kind of sentencing, bond hearing, whatever.
Well, it does. And people who pretend like that looks don't matter are being disingenuous. They matter to all of us.
Yep.
We formulate opinions and impressions based on how people appear to us, and it's based on our life experience. Now, people who had been living. And if that had grown up looking like what he looks in the picture on the left, they wouldn't have the same reaction that a person who grew up worshiping in a Southern Baptist church. Well, I'm not picking on Southern Baptists, but they tend to dress very nicely. At least in my day, when I was going to Southern Baptist churches, you put on your Sunday best, and everybody, you're going to react differently when you see someone who looks the way he looks there. He would kind of look scary to the average person.
Yes, I would. I would be fearful of that.
and we want safety, and we're going to look at, well, I'm on the jury here, and I'd rather be safe than sorry. Boy, that guy looks like he could be very scary, but that's not the way you're supposed to do it.
Right.
But that's the way you do it. I was at a Target store the other day, and there again, the labor shortage comes to issue. It comes up in terms of how desperate they are to hire people. And they have been known as one of the better employers for a long time. And in fact, they're trying to get their starting wage up to 15. I think they're at 13 an hour now. But I had to talk to a guy that had such a big bolt and screw set in his nose that I had to hear him breathing through it because it was obstructing his air passages. And I did not want to hear that.
Did he have Frankenstein on his name tag?
No, he didn't have Frankenstein, but just me having to hear that noise was more than I could stand. And I was irritated about it. And it was like, well, that's a prejudice of mine. I shouldn't be that way. But I am. I found it irritating. I'm thinking, why can't these people put him in the back room, you know, cleaning up the dumpster or something? Why is he out here on the sales floor? I shouldn't have reacted that way, but I'm human, right?
No. I think I can probably get some support to rally around that you are not human.
Okay, well, I'm Vulcan, but still, I reacted in a way that...
I reacted in a rational way. Rational way.
And he might be a very dependable worker. He might show up exactly on schedule. He might be very good at helping customers. I just didn't want to hear all that noise.
Yes. All right, well, we beat that dead horse. Only a handful of articles left. I should have known that this existed. Leading for-profit prison and immigration detention medical company. I didn't realize that existed. They were sued at least 1,395 times. You would have to think if there's going to be private prisons that there would be private medical prison facility kind of things. I just didn't put it together. But they have a boatload of infractions that civil rights violation kind of things, and offering less than great care or even adequate care to inmates. And a Colorado Springs attorney decided to sue Core Care Solutions. And yeah, good times.
I put it in there just to give me a chance to pontificate. I like to remind people who talk about the private sector as the solution to all problems and government is the evil. And I'm not saying that government prisons don't have their problems. Absolutely, they do. But as I've said many times, it's very hard to find. And it was only like in the last year I found someone who said they preferred a private prison over a government-operated prison. And they said because of the air conditioning versus the public prisons they didn't have.
I would say it too. I would tell you that.
But people who are in privatized prisons don't tend to give very good reports about the quality of the staffing, mm-hmm. the quality of the food, the quality of the medical, and the quality of the programming or anything like that. And this company to be sued this many times is alarming. and I just put it in there to remind people that it not only does the government do things sometimes with not the best of outcomes, the private system, their private free enterprise system also does things with not the best of outcomes. That's the only reason I put it there, is that you can't say government's all bad. You can't say the private sector is all perfect and pure as the wind-driven snow.
I do have to say in this particular, like this focused on this particular situation, I don't think that you can be profit-driven to be successful unless you tie your profit to the success of the people that you're being charged with. They are just being, their contract is only like to keep these people inside the walls and more or less alive. That is their whole incentive structure. It's not like, hey, can you guys do better? Almost like the charter school model. Can you guys do better at releasing offenders back into the public? Can you prove that you've done a better job? And then you could focus all of your energy down that way if they could prove that there's lower recidivism rate and so forth, and not cherry picking their inmates.
Well, that was the debate we had here. Our state, I believe, still has the highest percentage of its beds under private management of any of the states. And that was what they said here, was that we can actually do all those things and we can do it better, because the way they cast the public system was that it's an employment of nepotism and incompetent people and too much bureaucracy in the prison. And we need to get those people, kind of like the what you hear about public schools. There's too much administration. There's too much. We need to get these resources into the classroom. Well, they use the same argument about the prisons. They said that we can do it more efficiently, and we can clear out all the bureaucracy, and we can provide for better outcomes. Now, I have not seen any statistical evidence to back that up.
Right.
And I don't know if they've actually compiled any in terms of recidivism rate of people who have been in the private system. And unfortunately, you may meander through our system. You may be in a public facility for a while, and then you may go to a private. It's probably the same way in other states, but you don't exclusively stay in public or private, depending on your stay in the corrections department. Was that your experience? You kind of meander your way through public and private facilities
I did, but my experience is that people generally got slotted into one or the other and they stayed there. I ended up moving between two state facilities or two private facilities. Then I moved on then to state facilities because of classes that I was required to take.
Mm-hmm.
And the private ones didn't have the class at the time, or maybe not the right bed space for, you know, against the timeline that I was getting out. Because as you've brought up before, if the model of prison was to rehabilitate you, then you would start rehabilitation day one, not wait to 6 months or a year before you get out and start rehabilitating. Then just to check off a box that says, yeah, we've rehabilitated him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not how that my situation was at all. It didn't seem to go that way. It was like, oh, hey, he's got 12 months. We need to get him through these classes.
So I like what's coming next.
Yeah, this is good times, man.
Minute and a half of a clip here coming.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this was to set it up. It's from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I just to reverse engineer, there's a law that has come down where they're effectively banishing people from the city boundaries.
We've got hundreds of sex offenders here that we have no idea where they're living. Tulsa police say new sex offender registration laws are going to make that problem even worse when they take effect on Thursday. News on 6 crime reporter Lori Fulbright is on the story with a story you'll only see on 6.
Tulsa police say the new sex offender laws will essentially make the entire city of Tulsa out of bounds for sex offenders to live, which they say essentially makes citizens less safe than they were before.
This is where Tulsa sex offenders go to register. Starting Thursday, they're going to learn there is basically no place left in the entire city for them to live. The new law says no sex offender can live within 500 feet of any victim of any sex crime, whether that crime happened last year or 20 years ago.
Feel good legislation is all it is.
It also adds home daycares to the 2,000 foot rule. DHS has nearly 200 home daycares, which means all of those areas are now off limits.
Our legislators feel like, oh, they're just going to move. No, they're not. They're going to stay right here. They're just not going to register.
He says that defeats the whole purpose of the law, which was to let the public know where sex offenders live.
I put you in a room with 20 rattlesnakes. Do you want me to leave the light on where you can see them? Or do you want me to turn it off where you can't see them? You want the light on. You want to know where the sex offenders are living.
Tulsa has 460 registered sex offenders and one officer to keep track of them all.
How concerned are you about what's going to happen after that?
Well, I don't know how we're going to do it. I really don't. I don't know how we're going to find a place that they can live legally.
And of course, these law changes apply to everywhere in Oklahoma.
Police believe the sex offenders who are already living there won't have to move, but any new sex offenders who come in will have to abide by all these new laws. On the scene on the story in Tulsa, Lori Fulbright, News on 6.
I will contest his statement about would you rather know about the 20 rattlesnakes or not. You could easily not know that these people are there and probably not know any, you wouldn't know any difference otherwise. They shouldn't be there shouldn't be a registry to know where they're living or not. It just doesn't matter.
Well, that was when I first heard the part about this is feel good legislation. I'm thinking this is a police officer who actually gets it.
Right.
And then when he goes on to say that about the rattlesnakes, and we need to know where these people are and the community needs to know. I mean, the inference is totally bad there. But, you know, I take my glass half full. He did acknowledge that this is bad public policy.
The feel-good legislation.
Yes, and that you want to turn that into an asset. So the Oklahoma people need to convert him into their advocacy effort, and he needs to be willing. Clearly, if he's willing to say that on a television broadcast, he's willing to say that in a committee hearing. He needs to be at the Capitol in Oklahoma City talking about this feel-good legislation and about how it's going to actually undermine the very intent of the registry, which we don't support because the registry doesn't work. But you take whatever ally you can get, and, right. And that was good. The first part of his quotes were good.
What about the effective banishment of the city boundaries of Tulsa?
Well, they don't seem to be clear about it. It doesn't appear to be retroactive, but you're kind of stuck where you are, because once you move, then there's going to be a victim within zone of everybody that anywhere you'd want to live. And then, of course, how are you to know do they have a list of victims on pinpoint locators for an offender to know when you're shopping for an apartment that there's a victim? I don't see how this could possibly work.
Oh, and you could be a victim from another state. And does that mean there's a victim registry? And now you as a victim have to go in and register with your local police so that they can know.
I would almost have to think that this whole thing is silly and nobody had the, you know what, to tell them over there and when they were debating this. And it would be hard to vote no, because you'd be voting against victims. Without someone laying it out succinctly, it would be hard to vote against something like this.
That's funny.
But it's not really banishment, because you can be in Tulsa, like I say, if you take the literally constructive, if what banishment is understood in colonial times, banishment was not letting people be in town during the daytime to shop and spend money, and then they have to leave at night. Banishment was you had to leave and not come back into town.
Right.
And these people are not being told to leave Tulsa. They're just being told that you can't live within, what was it, 2,000 feet of a victim?
Right, but then there was also the daycare. I think it was 2,000 feet of a daycare facility. Also,
right, but they're not banishing you. You can still do business and commerce in Tulsa. You just can't live there.
Oh, I you always go back to that. You're not banished. You just can't stay. I know.
If you want to be a literalist and go by, and courts have interpreted banishment, looking at what I think I gave an example of a challenge in Alabama with the McGuire case. the district judge said, well, as I study banishment, banishment was not telling people that they have to not live somewhere. It was telling them you have to leave the territory. And they're not telling the sex offenders you have to leave the territory. That's not banishment as it was understood in colonial times. Now, you don't want to expand the definition of banishment to include just where you can't sleep at night, do you? Because banishment, we should look at that through what the framing founding fathers would have thought at the time, right?
Now I think you're poking fun at people.
Well, I'm trying to get people to think.
I know. I'm poking fun back. Yeah, I don't, if you can't sleep, to me, it feels more like if you can't sleep there, sleeping is a third of your time, give or take, not to mention the time that you would spend doing your personal hygiene and maybe doing some cooking stuff. You spend 50%, if not 60 or 70% of your time in your home and you can't be there. That would be banishment.
Well, that's an expanded definition of banishment, but it wasn't how the founding fathers would have understood it.
Yep, that's because everybody lived 20 miles away by a horse that took you 3 days to get to town.
Yeah, well, but you're a originalist, aren't you?
I am not. I can see some points that make sense to be, but no, I am not one of those people.
Oh. All righty.
Well, all right. The next article, the penultimate article is, do you see how they spell this word, the first word of the article? That's interesting. Them crazy UK people, they spell words funny. This is from Sky News, and I have a clip. It's not the best clip. And also, I warn you now, they talk funny. They talk really, really funny. But the article title is Pedophile Hunters Banding Together to Track Down Suspects.
Don't start with the crocodile tears.
Yeah, we're not interested in that, mate. What about if they were children? How do you think them children would feel?
We're here for your online activities that you've been doing.
Let's first message to you. I'm 11. She stated her age straight away.
Sorry for what? You're sorry you've been caught?
He's a slow groomer. He's, I think he's done it before. He's been done it quite a few times before in terms of his language and what he's talking about. I feel he's quite a dangerous individual, especially with the amount of children that you're speaking to.
Pictures that I've just handed out are images of the male and the current image of him, what he's believed to be looking like at this moment. We've verified that through a video call. So it is 100% this male that we're going to see tonight.
No. We've listened to your phone calls. We've read your chat.
You're well educated, mate. Your chats.
No. Do you know what damage it can cause a child? This joking. No, it's not. Sorry. You can damage these children for the rest of their lives.
I think then they show that the guy gets taken away in handcuffs. What do you think about vigilantes?
Well, it's the reality of the time we're living in, and government is assisting it, and it's tragic.
Do you want me to play the clip of the rioters again, the protesters?
No, I don't think so. I don't know why we're glorifying vigilantism in this country. The sheriffs in Georgia were promoting it with their signs. Certainly, if they weren't promoting it, they were making it more
socially acceptable. Yeah.
They were making people who would not have thought about it when they see a sign like that. I don't know what to say. What have we come to? Where have our morals gone?
Well, now that said, this is in the UK. This is in Manchester, so it's not us. But we've covered the subject before, and we've seen similar things of people in the US. They stage fake victims to chat with somebody online that's pretty much the definition. To me, that's the definition of entrapment, except for you throw in that as soon as you knew that the person was underage, that you would have stopped, then it would be entrapment if they continued to pursue you.
Well, I mean, but we've got similar schemes operating here in the United States.
Yeah.
where they're pretending to be something they're not to get people to come. These are not official law enforcement groups that are doing this.
Yeah.
Didn't we do it on a couple of podcasts
ago? We did.
Yeah,
it's probably six or so episodes ago. Yeah, that's not cool. And like I said, the people there, that's some pretty thick accent stuff going on there.
It was hard to understand some of what they were saying.
Yes, them crazy Brits, man. And the last article is from Nevada Current. Voting from jail, if not convicted, it's a right. So election is on Tuesday. So if you can, get out to vote. If you know somebody that can vote, get them to do us a favor and vote the right way. But we have a bunch of states where you can't vote. How do you think the Florida one's gonna come out with the felons are banished from voting for forever? Do you think that's gonna pass?
The indications are from the polling data I've seen that has to be a super majority. I forget what the level is, but the indications are that there's a very good chance it's gonna pass. Of course, sex offenders are excluded from that, as usual.
Yeah, it was violent crimes and sex offenders, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
If all life as we know it does not end after these people, assuming this passes, there's nothing to stop another amendment other than the political will to do it. But it's a step in the right direction. It's tragic that the people were left out that were left out.
Right. Well, the article, again, we've covered it before, but it's just another article that's supporting that even as a convicted felon, maybe not while you're in prison, but post-prison, and if not, while you're still on supervision, absolutely, after you're done with supervision, you should just automatically, without doing anything, it should just flip a switch and you should be able to vote again. And, you know, there's the two states where you can vote even while you're in prison. Oh, wait, you know what? I take that, like, this article is about if you... Let's, you know, you're driving without a license, whatever, you're trying to go to work.
This is about pretrial detention.
Right. And you end up getting locked up and you happen to cross over November 6th while you're still in lockup. And you've missed your chance to vote. I can see some angles in there where you're, you know, if you are, you know, you're politically active, you could have adversaries come after you and put you in lockup to prevent you from being active. Up to and leading to the election.
Absolutely. But there's certainly logistical challenges with trying to turn detention facilities where people are in detention pretrial into an election. But it can be done. Apparently, there in this article referenced where they had done it, right?
Yeah. Why couldn't you just have absentee ballots just there at the jail? Well, it doesn't sound like that would be that hard. You've said your state, you can vote anywhere in the state.
Anywhere in your county.
Oh, anywhere in your county, not anywhere in the state. Okay. Yeah. It doesn't sound like it would be that hard to extend it out to the state either, to me. You know, we do have these things called computers.
Well, yeah, we have ballot on demand, so you can go to any voting location, and when they pull your registration up, they can generate your ballot. But in prison, I mean, would it be possible to have a ballot on demand system where they could generate that person's ballot? I suppose so.
But we could pull it off.
Absentee ballots usually have to be requested, and you have to apply for, and then you wait for it to come, and then you have to send it back, and you have to send it in an outer envelope, and then put it in an inner envelope, and then they separate them so that there's anonymity, and but logistically, I think it can be done. You'd have to have the will to do it, and there's the fear that people in prison are going to vote the wrong way. I don't know that fear is justified. I overwhelmingly find people that have been incarcerated are very conservative. And it's conservatives that generally seem to be so frightened of people voting. And it seems like this would be a new voting block for them because people that come out of jail seem to vote conservative as far as I can see. So maybe this would actually enhance their voting totals.
They certainly do seem to be shutting down voter suppression.
You were in a prison, but did you meet more liberals or more prisons experience?
I don't even know how to answer that. People are so generally they're incredibly disengaged from the process in its entirety. They're not informed on the subject. Wouldn't say that's terribly different than the general population in general. People just do not care.
But when people said hip hip hooray, were they saying hip hip hooray to Obama or were they saying hip hip hooray to somebody else?
Well, in Georgia, it's a very, 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 very heavy majority of people are of color in prison. So when Obama got elected, it was a big deal. I mean, they were very happy.
So but the people
I suspect
color.
If you were in Minnesota. Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's just very heavily black people in prison here in Georgia. So you're not going to like jump up and say, no, oh, now you're a racist. So that wouldn't go over well, at least not from my experience. And that was my first time and hopefully last time ever experiencing that situation. I was a little scared.
Well, my experience is that most of them identify more politically on the right. People that have been incarcerated, they tend to espouse very conservative principles. And so I think the conservatives may be needlessly frightened by the thought of people who have criminal records voting, because I don't think it'd be a disaster to them that they think it might be. If you add 1 million felons in Florida to the voting rolls, you may end up having almost 600,000-700,000 voters on your team.
Right. Yeah. No, I understand your logic there. I hadn't quite considered it that way when you brought it up to me the first time, maybe a month or two ago.
All right.
So where do they text the prize number?
I have given up on that number.
My bad.
We're gonna close that number down and get a new number. It was difficult for us Wednesday night to get that thing out there.
Larry, tell people how they can share the podcast and help our audience grow.
Well, I've been telling them that for a long time now, but you can share the podcast and help us grow by spreading the word, and people should listen to this great production. Registrymatters.co.
What's the phone number that they can reach us at?
I'll do my best. 747-227-4477. That's
747. Why am I laughing so hard?
Like the airplane. Because on the broadcast of Wednesday night, I had the area code down to 727. But the part you don't tell the people was that after the final notice went out, I asked you people, I said, are people texting in, entering the comp? Oh yeah, I'm getting them. And then later on.
I had to say that on the program. I couldn't say nope, nothing. Cause then it'd be like, God, nobody likes us.
Then I
happened to look back through the email and saw that. I was like, oh, now I know why there aren't any messages. So some poor sap out there with a 727, the rest of the number, got a lot of strange text messages.
If there's such a number in existence.
Right. But how can people help? How can people email us?
The way that the previous people did last week.
Oh, wow, that's helpful. So they have to listen to episode 48 to figure out how to email us.
Or they could do it at registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And then what is the best way to support the podcast?
Win the lottery and give us 10%.
Ooh, wow, that's a neat idea. So let's see, it was what, 2 billion? Was it 2 billion that came out?
Well, close to it. I think the $1.5 billion and another $500 million. So yeah, close to $2 billion.
Wow, man, that would be $200 million straight to Registry Matters. Yeah, that'd be all right.
Do you think that would help get us through the lean times?
Yes, we would make it through the lean times then. So how can what's the best way?
Patreon. Patreon.com/registrymatters.
What is the minimum amount that someone can give us?
$1 per month.
That sounds like a bargain. This is a lot of information and content and material for a dollar.
Yeah, and you get to. I started to say you get to kick your radio, but nobody's using radios anymore.
Nobody's using radios.
What would they pound on when they're mad at us? What would be the equivalent of turning the radio off? If they threw
their phone, because most people, I would think, do podcasts over their phones. If you throw your phone, then you've just thrown $1,000 device at the wall, and that just sounds like a bad idea.
Well, or else you could have a $30 one like me, and then you could afford to throw it at the wall and go get another one.
All right, then. I guess that's one way to look at it. Yeah. So, that's all I got, Larry.
Well, thank you for being with us tonight on Registry Matters.
Thank you very much, and FYP.
And thank everyone for their support and listening to us, and do try to help us grow. We need to double this podcast by one year from now.
That would be awesome. I don't think that's hard to do. I think we should set that higher, but double sounds good.
Well, we can go for triple then.
All right, triple it is. So we need triple numbers. Anybody that wants to reach in and know what the numbers are to help us get there.
So, all right.
Later, man.
Good night.